This is Conducting Business, a podcast of WQXR.org. I'm Naomi Lewin. For male classical singers, it's one of the most exotic and rarefied careers you can choose. In the pop world, it's part of what many singers do from time to time. Men singing in the stratosphere holds a certain fascination for music fans, whether you're talking about the Bee Gees or Michael Jackson or countertenors. Countertenors are having a banner season here in New York with two productions at the Metropolitan Opera featuring male singers who ascend to stratospheric heights. For example, this is Andreas Scholl from his November 14th performance in the Metropolitan Opera production of Rodelinda. Andreas Scholl joins us here in our studio. Welcome, and please say hello so that we can hear your speaking voice as opposed to your singing voice.
Hello.
Also joining us is Brian Zieger, a pianist who is head of the Vocal Arts Department at Juilliard and the Metropolitan Opera Lindemann Young Artist Development Program. And on the phone from California is Chloe Veltman, the host and producer of VoiceBox, a radio and podcast program about all aspects of singing. Chloe, you wrote a whole article on this for the newspaper The Guardian. So please explain, what is a countertenor?
Well, a countertenor, unlike a boy soprano or a female soprano or alto, is a grown male, an adult male, who sings in the sort of similar registers as those higher voices normally associated with women and children. The voices have a lot more power, though. It's a voice that doesn't sound anything like a boy chorister or a female singer. It has a unique quality of its own.
And for the record, please define a castrato and say what the difference between a castrato and a countertenor is.
Okay, well, castrati were around, and well, they were popular in the 18th century. And these were singers that had been given the snip, so to speak, when they were entering puberty. So the idea was to preserve the beautiful high voice that they had had when they were young. And so what you got was, at the time, was an adult male with a high voice. And these castrati were extremely popular. They were the rock stars of their era. And the opera composers of the day wrote extremely florid, showy, bravura arias for them. And they played before crowds of thousands in the opera houses. And they were absolutely adored.
Now, Andreas, we have heard your speaking voice. How did you decide that this was your singing voice? Because it's obviously not your speaking voice.
In a way, it was never a real decision, but it's something that happened. I started to sing in a boys' choir at the age of 7. We had daily singing lessons, weekly individual vocal coaching sessions with a vocal teacher, and the voice broke at maybe a tiny bit later than usually at around 13, 14 years. I managed to continue singing in my head voice. This is what I refer to when I talk about the countertenor voice. It's my head voice. And this vocal coach said, well, the voice still is flexible. Let's see how long we can extend the high voice. And I think at the age of 16, I changed from soprano to alto. And from that moment on, I never sung anything else. So this is the continuation of my children's voice, in a way.
Now, there is a YouTube video out there of you demonstrating the difference between singing countertenor and singing baritone. You can do both, but you chose countertenor, or why
did
you?
It's actually quite funny. It's the same vocal apparatus that creates the sounds, the same vocal cords, but still as a baritone, I feel like a beginner. I don't know, maybe not like a beginner, but I have the same musical ideas, of course, but I can't put them or create the same sounds with a chest voice than I can do with a head voice. So it's not as flexible as the head voice. And I think it's simply the fact that I never really trained the baritone, but I kept on training the head voice.
Brian, the Met has two productions this season that involve countertenors: Handel's opera Rodelinda, which is running right now, and The Enchanted Island, which opens on New Year's Eve. Why are countertenors hot now?
Well, I think it's an extension of the public's interest in this marvelous Baroque repertoire. They're part and parcel of the way Baroque composers cast their operas, the way they thought through all the different characters. And I think we're lucky to be living in an age of wonderful artists like Andreas Scholl, like David Daniels, Bejin Mehta. You can name a whole bunch of people who are just artists of the highest caliber. One doesn't even have to think that they're in a special category. They simply stack up with all of the other marvelous singers at this time. And I have to say, as an educator, it's interesting for me to watch the people who knock on our door at the Met Opera in terms of our training program or at Juilliard. Many more young singers, let's say in their undergraduate studies or even in high school, we're even getting 17 and 18-year-olds that are coming in with countertenor repertoire that want to train in that.
Really?
What's
the percentage of kids?
Well, it's still fairly low, but and the fact is, in any given training program, I mean, you wouldn't want to flood it with countertenors because there simply aren't enough shows to go around with enough roles. But I would say the percentage is certainly growing, and we're getting some very sophisticated young people who are modeling themselves on Andreas, on David, on these wonderful artists that are singing now because they're just so excited by this music and by the kind of artistry they hear.
Another thing that I'm noticing in the choral world is that we're seeing countertenors appearing in alto sections, in choruses.
Yes.
That's something that a few years ago I just didn't see at all, but now I'm regularly seeing countertenors in those alto sections, and it kind of creates an interesting dynamic. And I know in the chorus that I sing in San Francisco, the International Orange Chorale, the arrival of a countertenor in the alto section caused some issues, actually, because you don't have the same kind of blend when you suddenly throw a man in there.
And there was a whole recent set to between Jay Leno and the group Chanticleer, because Jay Leno made fun of them, and then they made fun of them specifically singing high, and they turned around and made a video fun of him.
Mm-hmm.
Andreas, there was a countertenor who entered Britain's Got Talent, the British version of American Idol, and Simon Cowell equated his singing to...
It was like a dog meowing. Just shouldn't do that.
Now, some people must just find it really weird to see a guy like you open his mouth and have a sound like that come out. And what do you say to them?
Well, there are two elements. First of all, it's an element of surprise. That's for sure. The social conventions of society teach us this is how men behave. This is how a man is supposed to sound. We associate men with the lower kind of voices and women with higher kind of voices, also in daily life. So men use the head voice to make fun of women. Hello, how are you? So they use their head voice in order to create that effect. But it's not generally accepted that a man sings high. So first of all, it's kind of a surprise. How is that possible? But secondly, I mean, it's like sopranos. There are so many sopranos and so many women who call themselves sopranos. It's not a, unless I say I'm a diplome soprano, or it's not a protected term. So everybody can say I'm a soprano, I'm an alto. The question is, how far does this talent go? And the truth is, and I'm sure that my colleagues like David and Bejun, or also Yestin Davies, who sings with me now at the Metropolitan Opera, they would all agree that with the fashion that came along with countertenors, there's also many countertenors who love the idea of being a countertenor, but unfortunately, that alone is not enough. It's it also takes talent. I compare it to, if we say, like a photo model, I don't know, Cindy Crawford, she's beautiful, yes, and that's the basis of her success. Of course, she needs to work and be intelligent and put work into her career. But ultimately, what creates her success is something that she did not create by herself. It's a gift, and that gift needs to be there. And as much as I'd like to be a very fast runner and I train as hard as I can, it's not just training that gets me there, but there needs to be a kind of natural gift.
Brian, why is it that people laugh at Tiny Tim, but then they go nuts over other men who sing high, countertenors like Andreas Scholl or Chris Martin of Coldplay or the Bee Gees? Are there good and bad kinds of falsetto singing?
Well, sure, as there are in all singing. I mean, Tiny Tim was pretty silly, but when you see an artist with as much obvious seriousness and focus and specificity as Andreas or David or the people we're mentioning, I mean, they come on stage as full-fledged artists. I think, as Andreas mentioned, for audience members that simply haven't encountered this before, the first 10 or 20 seconds, they're kind of in shock. They don't quite know what they're hearing. But once you hear them sing a few phrases and you understand that they're phrasing with the same intention, their artistic goals are exactly the same as René Fleming's, who's with Andreas, or any of his colleagues, you just very quickly get over that. It's actually quite a superficial difference, because the artistry and the way they're using the music, the way they're using the words, is exactly the same.
Now, Chloe, in your Guardian article about countertenors, you wrote, "For putting people in the mood, there's nothing quite like hearing a man sing really, really high." Now, that seems really, really counterintuitive. Doesn't a high male voice imply just the opposite? Something
it does, and in fact, research studies show that the speaking voice in a man, women tend to favor low speaking voices in men. But when it comes to singing, it seems like something else kicks in, some other feeling. I was very intrigued because I'd been to see a performance of Jersey Boys, the musical, and it was interesting to me that every time the actor who played Frankie Valli went up into his high register, the entire audience and the women, because I could hear those voices, were screaming in shock and excitement. And it reminded me of video footage I'd seen of the Beatles groupies doing the same thing when John Lennon and Paul McCartney went up into their high registers. So I went researching to try and find out what was behind this, and I spoke to a neuroscience professor, David Huron, at Ohio State, and what he told me was that when singers sing high and loud, this releases hormones into the brain, which causes a sort of general increase in physical arousal. You get higher heart rate, greater attentiveness, perspiration, you perspire more, and you breathe faster. There seems to definitely be a kind of a weird sexual awakening that happens in a lot of women and also in some men when they hear these really high-pitched, physically exciting sounds. The other thing as well is I think this extends to the physical appearance, this whole concept of a gentle giant. So, for example, you have a singer like Steve Tyler who looks like a caveman, who looks, you know, really, really virile and manly, but then sings, in a sense, like a choir boy. Same with David Daniels, who I saw on stage recently in San Francisco. He just finished up, or he's just finishing up a run in Xerxes. So, yeah, it seems that there's a definite playing with our expectations and an arousal that takes place.
And it's not just an arousal of women. Brian, countertenors right. have a definite following in the gay community.
That's
and
true.
Many
yep.
countertenors are gay, present company accepted. Brian, why do you think that is?
Oh, gee, that's a bit of a puzzle to me. I just think there are so many gay opera lovers that are bound to cross over into all kinds of opera. But I think what's interesting just to think about as an audience member also is that the notes which are exciting for Andreas or for David are not different in pitch than the ones that are exciting for Pavarotti or for Domingo. I mean, we're dealing with the same pitches on the scale. They're produced differently, and they have a different relationship to the overall voice. But I think Chloe has an interesting point, but the fact is that the top of anyone's range, or, you know, a beautifully focused, well-produced voice is an arousing thing. It's exciting to anyone who is a meloman, who really loves sound and loves voice.
Andreas, do people assume that since you sing countertenor, you are gay?
The question comes up quite often. So my piano accompanist of many years, Markus Merkel, who is gay, is frequently asked, "So you work with Andreas, is he gay?" And I think it's probably statistically there are as many gay men in the arts world than there are in the business world. The problem is just that the environment of the arts world is far more liberal and open-minded towards this subject. So, but representative, I think it's the same amount of people. Probably there are many more gay men that are married and have children because they can't, they have to suppress it, again, because of this social conventions that we have. And I think that's also part of the attraction of the countertenor, the high male voice, is that it transcends the clichés that we have of what's masculine and what's feminine. I mean, of course, I can fulfill the operatic cliché of belting out loud sounds and I'm a macho on stage, or I can have a slightly more sophisticated idea of what's masculine, which also changes. I mean, in the Middle Ages, a true knight needed to be able to write poems and play an instrument, which is not something we think today a true macho needs to do. So it shows how fast over the centuries, or even over a decade, the idea of what's truly masculine or feminine changes.
And after all, we're talking about an opera world where Susan Graham plays Octavian and makes love to Renee Fleming on the, you know, in the opening of Rosenkavalier. I mean, opera in general is about a kind of suspension of disbelief. And I think people who love opera and understand the magic of that art form will readily understand that we're there to experience all different lenses on sexuality, lenses on what it is to play a character, what it is to take part in a story that transcend all kinds of everyday boundaries.
And also the idea of humanity.
Yeah.
That primarily we're human beings, and then society, well, biology and divides us into men and women, and then society gives us rules of how to behave. But there are so many positive aspects in feminine behavior that men should adopt, and they don't do it because it's, well, you simply don't do it. So I think the countertenor voice on stage probably lives out a fantasy of men and women being to be a human being, to not suppress positive elements that are associated with the other sex just because society doesn't accept it. So the countertenor can be the complete human being without having this separation of man and woman.
Countertenors and castrati traditionally sing male roles in operas. How did those roles end up being written for these men's voices singing in what is actually a woman's tessitura rather than for tenors or basses?
Yeah, I think in the Baroque time it comes down to this idea the true hero is superhuman. He transcends the cliché of a man, and it's always about the development. If we look at Handel's operas, the story always tells about a human being at the beginning of the opera is not really complete, lacks things. If we look at Giulio Cesare, he's a strategic thinker. He lacks his soft side. He lacks heart and empathy.
That's Julius Caesar.
Julius Caesar. Yeah. And if we look at Cleopatra in the beginning of this opera, she's a spoiled child. Although she carries responsibility for her people of Egypt. So then through the two of them meeting, they become more complete human beings because they both complement each other. And I think that's the attraction, so that the most heroic roles in Baroque opera were sung by men who sing like women, as we would say these days. And I think to us today, it sounds a bit like a contradiction, but I think that's exactly why they were singing these heroic roles, because they were true superhuman superheroes that transcended the simple ideas of how they should behave.
Chloe, I'm going to throw this one to you. In the middle of the 20th century, there was Alfred Deller in England, there was Russell Oberlin in America, and that was pretty much it, countertenor-wise. Mm-hmm. When did the great resurgence of countertenors start?
Well, it really did start with Deller and Russell Oberlin. I mean, these were the guys that began at the very beginning to make this voice, which had been not heard, had been more or less banished from the classical music opera stages for some decades at least, come back again into vogue. I think it was that voice that started people thinking again that there could be a future for countertenors, and it kind of spun out from there. And, you know, you have this generation now with Andreas and David Daniels and Philippe Jaroussky, who's been touring around with Apollo's Fire. And they're drumming up huge audiences now and thousands of fans and fan sites on the web and so on.
Brian?
You know, a lot of 20th century and now 21st century composers have found also that the variety that a countertenor voice can bring to an opera cast. I could think of Thomas Addis in The Tempest, which will be coming to the Met in a couple of seasons. Jonathan Dove in his opera Flight has a prominent character, and many oratorios now include countertenors. In fact, the piece we're doing at Juilliard just this week, which is a U.S. premiere by Peter Maxwell Davies, there's a role written for a young boy, which is specified in the score, countertenor or mezzo. So I think composers are just simply realizing there's a marvelous pool of talent around. They want to use it for variety, for spicing up their score with a different sound.
And when did countertenors sort of start taking over the castrato repertoire? Is that after Marilyn Horn dug it up again?
Well, it came with the revival of the early music world. I mean, in the 1970s.
The Met, though, uses modern instruments.
Yes, and of course it's a fantastic spot to sing as a countertenor, because we always, as artists, have to strive to expand what we do. Otherwise, you just circle around yourself all the time. And of course, this is not the typical early music audience. And if you manage to convince this audience it's not about the individual voices. It's about this wonderful opera, Rodelinda, for example. It's gorgeous music. And if the cast effort, the team effort, results in people saying, oh, I love Baroque opera, then that's a great thing. And you're in a way a pioneer if you're part of this cast at this opera house that makes something that pleases the audience.
Yes, Brian.
I think also a singer like Andreas or Justin Davies, who's singing with him in Rodelinda, you know, they're on a stage which was not built for Baroque repertoire. We understand that roughly 4,000 seats,
right,
as you say, a modern instrument orchestra, and with people like Stephanie Blythe, Renee Fleming, who sing Verdi, who sing all the, you know, Strauss, all these full roles. They absolutely have disproven this notion also that countertenors normally have smaller voices, are only suited to more intimate stages. They can really do the whole range. There's simply no limit to artists of that level.
Full disclosure, I am a mezzo-soprano, and to me, countertenors are guys who take away work from mezzo-soprano.
I heard that before. And to be honest, if I was a conductor or a stage director and I could choose between a good contralto or mezzo-soprano and a bad countertenor, I would always prefer the better singer. I wouldn't care whether there's a countertenor if he's not at least as good as the female competition. And I think your reaction comes from what I mentioned beforehand, that through this fashion of, oh, countertenors are so hip. In Europe, I could certainly observe this, that many conductors said, oh, I want to have a countertenor in my cast. Whereas all other singers needed to audition and were scrutinized carefully, the countertenor was kind of a phone number. Oh, well, I know somebody, he sings countertenor, and he gets out the high notes. We don't expect him to be musical or especially intelligent. As long as he sings high, that's okay. So you had within the Christmas oratorio, you had wonderful soloists, and then you had the quotation countertenor, the guy who sings high. But he fell into this special category, so nobody expected him to sing especially musical. And I can understand that mezzos or contraltos get angry if they hear bad singing and they don't get the job.
It's also worth mentioning that artists like Andreas and David also are wonderful recitalists. I mean, they have every right to a Schumann song or a Schubert song that all their colleagues do, and they do a beautiful job with that.
I would say it's probably 60-70% of my work is still recital work, and then it's very lucky that I have that many recitals.
Really? So where does a person go if a young boy decides this is what I want to do in life? Where do you go to study if you want to be a countertenor? Because I imagine there are not a lot of programs out there.
Well, I think that young boy has to think the same way that all of his young singer friends would. You'd have to look for the best school and the best training. I mean, sometimes they apply to a school like Juilliard. I can only speak for Juilliard, which I know well. And we're happy to accept them, but they have to be absolutely at the same level as anyone else, with the same curiosity about language, about culture, the same musical tools. It's absolutely parallel training. And I would say all of our faculty at Juilliard have trained countertenors over the...
But I understand there aren't any there at the moment.
No, but we have had some over... We also had a Michael Magnacci, who actually was a male soprano. He was in a kind of a special category.
Great singer. But I worked with him.
Yeah.
I heard him in Cincinnati. He is a fantastic singer.
We actually have several auditioning this year that I know of. And it's the luck of the draw. The fact is we only take 20 out of 750 applicants anyway. So if one of them happens to be a countertenor, that's good for them and good for us.
Do you need to study with a countertenor to
no.
be a
oh,
countertenor?
No,
no, that's
because that must really limit the...
I'm very happy about what Brian just said, that it's not... There is no exotic bonus...
Not at all.
..about countertenors. And any good vocal teacher can teach a countertenor. The approach would be, I believe, the same as teaching a contralto.
Exactly.
So, Chloe, do you think the countertenor voice is always going to be a novelty, or do you see it becoming mainstream?
You know, I don't think we'll necessarily get back to the days when people were following the Farinellis of the world around, trying to get...
Farinelli being the most famous famous castrato ever.
Right, yeah, back in the days when they were, you know, ridiculously big rock star celebrities. But, you know, with as I said earlier, with more countertenors appearing in choruses, for example, and with more of the major opera companies and recital series more regularly programming countertenors in roles that were played by women for many decades, I think that we're going to see a sort of a normalization.
Brian and Andreas, what do you think about whether this voice is going to be more accepted as mainstream as we go along?
It will be more accepted, but the funny thing is just a few weeks ago in the Met cafeteria. I sat there with my colleague Justin Davis, and we saw all the real singers. Actually, you know, that's what we think. There was even a funny German baritone, a sweet guy, said, "Oh, how is the light cavalry doing today?" Asking us. So there's like, it's like in boxing, you have the heavyweights, yeah, and then you have the bantamweights. So we felt like, hey, here's Ananet Repko, here's Jonas Kaufmann, René Pape, and then they're the countertenors. So, but it's probably just our own perspective, and we realized that it would be still a long way to. But I think it's probably in the nature of the countertenor voice. It expresses itself not through vocal strength that you can measure in decibel. There will never be a countertenor, I think, that can sing louder or stronger than Pavarotti or Domingo. There is a limit to the dynamic range of a countertenor, but so it, the countertenor expresses itself in a different way. Of course, tenors are the superstars of classical music, and there's a reason for it, and there's probably as many great contraltos, female contraltos, but they will never get that superstardom of the tenors or of the sopranos.
Well, we look forward, Andreas, to you forming the three countertenors. Thank you all for joining us. This has been the latest installment of WQXR.org's podcast series, Conducting Business, with guests countertenor Andreas Scholl, appearing at the Met in Rotolinda, writer and broadcaster Chloe Veltman from San Francisco, and voice coach and pianist Brian Zeger. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Wise is our producer, and Bill O'Neill engineered this session. I'm Naomi Lewin. Thank you so much for listening.